Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. And I've been so satisfied. No, I ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. This show used to be known as Let's Eat In, and I'm your host, Kathy Arroway, and it's a gorgeous day in Brooklyn. I'm joined today on the phone by a veteran cookbook writer, food writer, whose work has appeared in Sever, New York Times, and she is also the winner of the 2012 James Beard Award for Food Blogs. She writes, Poor Man's Feast. Alyssa Altman, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining today. And you recently published a wonderful memoir called Poor Man's Feast. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. So this story, it's actually a memoir. It's not a cookbook. It's a very narrative, memoir about your life, throughout, an earlier period in time, around the 80s or so.
Right, right. And basically, you know, as you say, it's not a cookbook, although there are 27 recipes that are sort of interspersed throughout the chapters. But basically, it's, you know, it's a simple story about complicated food issues and growing up in a complicated culinary household with a dad who used to actually sort of squirrel me away without my mom knowing about it and take me for these crazy, crazy meals at places like Le Grenouille and Côte Basque in the late 1960s and early 70s when I was very small. And my mom, my dad was just a huge food fanatic. He loved food in all of its guises and really taught me a lot of what I know about it culturally. And my mom, on the other hand, is a former model, and she was modeling as recently as 10 years ago, and she, let's just say, has a slightly different opinion of food and is like the quintessential New Yorker, you know, would store her sweaters in her stove if she could. And so I grew up with this very kind of crazy push-pull sensibility about food and what it meant. And what I gleaned from my upbringing was that it could be transformative, and that fancy food was always the best way to go. And you know, whether or not you were eating out or eating in, and so in the 80s, I decided to go to cooking school, and I was working at Dean and DeLuca at the time, the original Dean and DeLuca, and coming home and making crazy, crazy tall vertical meals because I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Right, I love that chapter about those Timbale molds that you're trying to create. You know, everyone has seen like those gorgeously architectural plated dishes in restaurants, and how they're supposed to look. And you know, you went out and grabbed some Timbale molds and tried to recreate it. So,
That's right.
I commend the effort. So I mentioned, like, this is a story that takes place a little while back because it reads like it's so lived in, and so you've come to so many discoveries and to a greater place of appreciation for food, a greater wisdom overall about food after a while. And it's really wonderful to read. Alyssa, if you don't mind, could I read a little passage?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Sure.
So this is somewhere in the middle, and I just love the sentiment. So chapter 12. In the way that some people believe you can always tell the nationality of a tourist by looking at their shoes or their underwear, I've always thought you could do the same by digging around in someone's kitchen. You can tell who they are, existentially speaking, just by opening cabinet doors, poking around the refrigerator, and pulling open a few utensil drawers. So that was a little snippet from Poor Man's Feast. And you go on to talk about how you discover your mother's kitchen and, you know, as you described, she's not so much a foodie.
And no, then, definitely not.
And then you go on to describe Susan's kitchen, which is what this chapter is all about, and what that has taught you, and what it teaches people, what food, I guess, teaches people about people. And throughout the story, which is actually a love story, this memoir, it starts sort of as, I remember the first chapter had a first date with Susan, and
right.
And then there's it ends with you eating bread and cheese alone at home. And at the end of the book, there's a sort of a little arc where you have enjoy bread and cheese together. So serving and sharing that simple pleasure together.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's it is very, very much a love story. And it took my meeting the love of my life, who is a quintessential bona fide Yankee through and through, raised in Northern Connecticut, in a very different kind of household than I was raised in, to a very different kind of family that I was born to. And Susan believed and still does believe that simple is always best. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the story follows, it sort of dashes back and forth across time periods and generations and decades. And, you know, the love story is thankfully still very current, which is nice.
Happy ending.
But she really taught me everything I now know to be true about food as sustenance rather than food as either entertainment or food as fuel. And that the act of, you know, the simple act of breaking bread with somebody is a great leveler.
Right. That's so rich with just resonance there at the end, just the simplicity of the bread and butter or cheese.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because Susan didn't go to culinary school like you did or go to all these or was taken to all these, five-star restaurants as a child like you were. But yet she has taught you more about food in the long run.
You know, I think it's, thank goodness she didn't go to cooking school, and thank goodness she didn't grow up going to all of these, these high-end restaurants, and thank goodness she didn't get a bee in her bonnet about, that being the way she was supposed to live and eat. But, you know, I think that it's a certain sort of sensibility that that she's got, and she has a sort of I'm a New Yorker. I was born and raised here, and so I come to the table with a frenetic sensibility that really sort of needs to be diffused, and I think that it needed to be diffused and it needed to be sort of simmered down, as the case may be. But and I think that that's true for a lot of people who grow up and live in the hustle and bustle of the city or any city, that, you know, we really need kind of a focused effort to pull us off the day-to-day craziness of food as entertainment and people yelling bam, at you and that kind of thing, and soup Nazis and stuff like that. And Susan grew up in northern Connecticut, as I said, and I think that she really came to our table with a much more, I don't want to say discerning sensibility, but a slower sensibility when it came to food. And, you know, she never had a television set sitting on the end of her table as a child, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
but we did, and I think a lot of people do. And so you kind of lose that sense from the outset of sitting down and eating together as a convivial way to live. And so she, that's part of what she brought to the table. And with that came the understanding that, you know, we live in this crazy society where food is entertainment, and, you know, people who don't know how to make a simple steak feel the need to go out and buy home sous vide kits for $700.
Right.
And that those same people usually can't poach a simple egg.
No, it's interesting. And, you know, that we have to take a calculated step back when we approach a meal sometimes. And even, you know, sometimes when I have a dinner party with friends or a potluck or something like that, it's, I have to sort of bite my tongue about mentioning, oh, yeah, and I saw this. Both, have you guys tried the fried chicken at blah, blah, blah? You know, if we're having fried chicken. And, you know, there's always like some sort of food media buzzing around in your head or something.
It's very, it's very hard to stay present. Mm-hmm. It really is. And I think that that seems to be our greatest challenge for a lot of people. You know, that we want to either sit down and eat and talk about other food, somebody else's food, or food television, or what the hottest chef is doing now, rather than just staying present with what you're eating mm-hmm. and the people that you're breaking bread with and enjoying what you're eating and their company.
And that must have been pretty tough for you, because you had been a food editor for a website at the time that you had met Susan. So it was also part of your career to be on top of this kind of
right.
thing. So.
Right. Yeah. No, I was the editorial director for a now long defunct website.
Okay.
And it was all about, you know, the hottest restaurants in the city and the hottest
right.
restaurants in every city.
Do you find that people, home cooks now that are maybe just picking it up for the first time, say, you know, fresh out of college grads, do you find that people or think that people are more informed about what to cook from what they see in restaurants rather than what they've seen in homes, even their own?
I do think so. Mm-hmm. And I think that just comes by way of, you know, where we are culturally. I mean, in most homes, you know, I grew up in a home with a mom, a dad, and a grandma who didn't live with us but lived right across the street from us, and so she was in the house all the time, and she was actually a wonderful cook. How she managed to have my mom, who can't cook her way out of a paper bag, no one knows, but you know, there was always home cooking going on, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. in my home. And, you know, fast forward to the present day, and I think we're getting better than we were, but there was a spate of time where, you know, both parents, if there were both parents worked. And maybe, you know, a kid would come home from middle school or junior high school, and maybe there was somebody at home, or maybe there wasn't. And I think that's just very common. That's just, you know, that's an example of families trying to make ends meet. And so, if that young child is going to get enticed by the act of cooking, that's probably going to happen by food television, mm-hmm. By the Food Network, or when, you know, one of the other shows that's out there, or PBS. And so, you know, we're getting our food information. Younger people are getting their food information in different ways right now.
Hence the Tim Bale molds. What exactly, these are like tin molds that come in various different heights that you basically squash food in and then push it out.
Pretty much.
So, yeah.
Pretty much. You know, they kind of look like overgrown thimbles. And I needed to have eight of them for reasons that now, you know, when I think about them, I think, you know, they would have been great to start seeds in. You know?
I love how you have this in a chapter about tall foods, and that's actually one of the distinctions between a restaurant plated dish and a home cooked dish. And, you know, it just strikes me reading this now that, you know, my parents growing up never tried to give some height or, you know, to their dishes, like a plate of spaghetti and meatballs. But height and, you know, kind of drama with plating is a huge deal, dealing with restaurants.
And I, you know, I think that a lot of that also comes from our access to food television and, you know, food publications and the belief that everybody has to be a chef. I mean, you can walk into any supermarket in the United States, anywhere in, and I just came off a 9,000-mile 10-city tour for the book, and so I've been everywhere, and you know, you can walk into any supermarket anywhere in this country and buy gourmet, quote-unquote gourmet-style products that have a famous chef's face, any number of famous chef's faces attached to them. And, you know, I think that there's this great misconception that we must cook fancy for us to cook well, and you know, nothing could be further from the truth.
All right, so let's take a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with Alyssa Altman.
Oh, well, I just want. You're listening to Thank You by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese, made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. So long, for I could sing this little song.
All right, we're back. This is Eat Your Words, and we're talking with Alyssa Altman, the author of Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking. Hi there again.
Hi there.
We're on the phone, so it's always strange doing this on the phone versus in person, so you don't see them right in front of you, but you're doing a great job. Thank you. So this book, this memoir falls into, it's an evocative, really rich memoir about food. Were there any other books that you were inspired by or authors when you approached this project?
I'm a voracious reader, and on that said, I do have my favorites. I mean, Laurie Colwin,
home cooking,
home cooking, and as well as her novels, which were, you know, in which food was just always sort of a secondary or in some cases a primary character. Who else? Nigel Slater's Toast, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, those books really have meant a tremendous amount to me over the years. And sitting in my office right now, you know, I'm looking up at sort of a wall of Laurie Colwin books. Mm-hmm. So I really, you know, I adored her writing and continue to.
Wonderful. How did you decide to write this book? Because you had started writing the blog Poor Man's Feast, and did that come first, or did you have this idea of writing the memoir?
No. I mean, the blog, I launched the blog in 2008, and just to see in, you know, when it was a slightly different format back then, but just to see if I could begin a conversation, a two-way conversation with other home cooks and, mm-hmm. and people who had sort of been down the same road that I had, you know, growing up in New York, being a New Yorker at a time in the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s when food was very big and it really resonated, thankfully resonated for a lot of people and a lot of readers. And eventually, you know, I started to see, and this is certainly the editor in me speaking, you know, I could see that there was a pattern, and there were certain that there were certain narrative threads that were making themselves known. And mm-hmm. and so back in 2010, I began to write the book, and here it is.
Yeah, and this is your first book.
It's a birthing process.
It is. That's wonderful. This is your first book, right?
This is actually my second book. My first book was a cookbook that came out in 2005 called Big Food, and it was about the concept of buying food in bulk and using absolutely everything that you buy. It's still in print.
That sounds great.
And and I'm actually at work on a sort of like a CSA version of it because you know, I live in Northern Connecticut now, and we have a big garden, so we're not CSA members, but some of our neighbors are. And if I hear the phrase, "What do I do with 8 pounds of turnips?" once more, I'll scream. So that's where the book is coming from.
Is that in response to perceived challenges of being in a CSA, or actual ones that people have found themselves in?
Well, I think it's a response to a lot of people coming up to me in farmers markets and saying things mm-hmm. like, "What do I do with all these beets?" And you know, I can't just buy a beet. If I'm buying, you know, a bunch of beets with beet greens, and mm-hmm. and you know, and how do I use everything that you know, that I get from either the farmer or from the CSA box? And so it's gotten some nice, you know, some nice traction, and that's sort of in process right now.
That sounds great. I can't wait to check that one out.
Thank you.
Congrats. So what was it like writing this very, very narrative and personal story compared to a cookbook?
Oh, it was about as different, you know, as different could possibly be.
Were you scared, or, you know?
You know, I was always very careful. Mm-hmm. It is, as you say, a very, very personal, deeply personal story. My blog tends to be very personal, and everything that I write I always run it past Susan. I mean, there's nothing, I never hit the publish button. I never hit send until I show her absolutely everything. Because, you know, one person's privacy is another person's conversation, and so it's very, very important to me to respect my partner's privacy, even though, you know, this is our story, and she's been really wonderful about it.
Well, that's great. And how about your parents? Because they're major characters in the book too.
I lost my dad back in 2002, and I would like to think that he'd be really pleased with this. He was always very, very supportive of my writing for as long as I was doing it. My mom actually has not yet read the book. So, you know, she's coming. I'm actually doing a signing in Brooklyn at Book Court this coming Sunday, and then another signing at Rizzoli in Manhattan next Thursday. And I know she's coming to the Rizzoli signing. So, you know, we'll see what the response is. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. That's all I can say.
That sounds great. I hope to make it to Sundays at Book Court.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah, so, okay, about the recipes in here, they look lovely, tempting, you know, simple Sunday pot roast, and then the next one is followed by what to do with leftovers from pot roast. How did you choose them? Were they sort of in relation to what was going on in the chapters, or?
Yes, they were always within context. They were always in context. So, for example, there's a recipe for an onion panade in the book, and that actually falls at the end of the Christmas chapter, where Susan and I celebrated our first Christmas together. And I had sort of visions of this kind of Dickensian glory with, you know, the flaming plum pudding and the goose, and of course we were only two people, and we got stuck in a terrible snowstorm and weren't able to actually leave the house to get to the supermarket to shop for Christmas dinner. So we used what we had, which was bread and cheese and stock and onions, and it was
that
great.
So good.
It's you know, I always describe it as onion soup without the soup.
Yeah. So I know that we can check out your blog too, but maybe a sneak peek or something, something that you're loving cooking right now.
Oh my
Anything
goodness. You know, right now, I just made something really wonderful. If I do say so myself, it was quite good. You know, we're heading into the warmer and end of spring, and the garden isn't quite there yet, but I'm loving making the sort of soup out of escarole and peas and asparagus, a little bit of tortellini, some really nice olive oil, and just very simple and very delicious.
Oh, was the escarole like overwintered or is it new?
We did have some overwintered kale kale that we actually picked yesterday, but no, this is unfortunately local supermarket escarole. And certainly when it comes up and when the asparagus are fresh, that dish is really just sings. It's really wonderful and couldn't be easier.
That sounds great because most people think of these escarole and those chicories as a salad green or to be cooked very lightly, like a sauté.
I cook the, I wilt the escarole in stock, and you can do it certainly in vegetable stock, if you're a vegetarian, or chicken stock, and it's probably 2-to-1 escarole to stock, and it's just sort of moistened, and it's lovely, and it kind of takes the bitterness out of it, which is also nice. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the sort of the sweet nuttiness of the asparagus and the sweetness of the peas and the saltiness of the Parmigiano Reggiano, and it's just lovely.
Oh, that sounds very spring-like and appropriate.
Yes,
something I can't wait to make soon. So, what is your favorite dish or recipe from the book, if any?
Oh, goodness. My favorite dish from the book, I would have to say it's either the warm tomato sandwich, which has to be made standing in a garden with a tomato that you've just picked off the vine.
I think that can be done pretty soon for a lot of folks this summer.
I think so. Not in Connecticut, but
okay.
not in Connecticut.
In theory, it can be done.
And I think just the poached egg, simple poached egg.
Sounds great. So, do you have any other upcoming book events or?
Well, as I said, I'm actually going to be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts on Friday night at 7:00, and at Book Court in Brooklyn on Sunday at 7:00, and the following Thursday at Rizzoli in New York at 6:00, and all of that is actually on my blog.
Wonderful. Everyone, check out poormansfeast.com for more on that and more stories and recipes. That's about all the time we've got now, but thank you so much for joining us, Elsa.
Thank you, Kathy. I really appreciated it.
All right. Have a great day. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.